Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we, unpack the key insights from different sources for you.
And today, we're diving into a really compelling conversation, actually. It's from Military Tales, their episode 33.
That's the one. Features Vietnam War vets who were Air Scouts talking at the American Flight Museum. It's quite something.
It really is. And these weren't just any pilots, right? Their role as Air Scouts was, well, incredibly risky and absolutely vital.
Super dangerous. And what's amazing, one of the vets in that discussion, Gary Worthy, he actually owns and flies a Loach helicopter today.
Yeah, he does it specifically to keep that history alive, which is fantastic.
So our mission today, digging into this episode 33 discussion, is basically to understand who these Air Scouts were, what their job really entailed in Vietnam, and, their legacy, all from their own words.
Okay, so starting with who they were. Bruce Huffman, in that episode 33 talk, he really breaks down the structure. They weren't just individuals out there.
Right, not lone wolves.
No, they were organized, usually in platoons, part of bigger air cavalry units, regiments, or squadrons.
And their main job?
Reconnaissance. Pure and simple, at its core. Find the enemy. Figure out their strength. That was job one. Critical intel.
Absolutely critical. But it wasn't just passive observation, was it? Huffman, in episode 33, talks about movement to contact.
Exactly. That's a key concept. It sounds like they were deliberately trying to, well, stir things up.
Yeah, draw enemy fire, get them to reveal their position.
Right. Draw fire, maybe suppress it a bit if they could, break contact, and then call in the cavalry, basically, or the artillery or air support.
Such a dynamic. And you just know, incredibly high-risk way to operate. You really feel that listening to them in episode 33.
Then Hugh Mills, another veteran on that panel, he adds this whole other layer. He wrote Low-Level Hell, and he talked about reading sign and trails from the air.
Which is fascinating. So not just looking for enemy soldiers, but for clues.
Yeah, like subtle things, broken branches, disturbed ground, stuff that tells you people have been through there. It's like combat tracking, but from a helicopter. Really specialized.
That really paints a picture of their skill set. So they're the eyes, often the first point of contact.
Potentially, yeah. And Bruce Huffman, again in episode 33, mentions their daily routines, first and last light missions.
Circling around the infantry positions.
Mm-hmm. Providing that aerial screen during those really vulnerable times, dawn and dusk. Imagine the responsibility.
No kidding. And he calls them the pinpoint of combat action.
Yeah.
Basically directing the firepower.
That really sums it up, doesn't it? They were right at the sharp end, guiding everything else in.
Okay, let's shift to Bruce Huffman's experience getting into it. He arrived late February 68, just after Tet.
Yeah, he joined Charlie Troop, 19th Cav, part of the 1st Air Cav Division. Initially, he wasn't even a scout pilot.
What was he flying then?
He started in the lift platoon, flying UH-1 Hueys. Their job was to bring in the infantry, the grunts, once the scouts found something.
So, still dangerous, inserting troops into a hot LZ.
Definitely. He mentions the risk involved in developing the situation with those infantry platoons on the ground, but then he transitioned
to the scouts, flying the OH-6.
Right, the little bird or Loach. And that's where he describes the Air Scout role as being like resource managers.
Resource managers. How so?
Well, think about it. From that little helicopter, they could call in artillery anything from 105s up to massive 175-millimeter guns. They could call in Air Force jets, Marine Corps, Navy air support via forward air controllers.
Wow.
And, of course, bring in more infantry reinforcements using the lift platoon he used to be in.
So a young pilot could potentially be coordinating a huge amount of firepower and manpower.
Huffman makes that exact point in episode 33. A young warrant officer might find himself responsible for the actions affecting nearly 800 soldiers in a big fight.
That's staggering responsibility. He makes a distinction too, right? Between just random contact and when the fight was on?
Yes, when it involved the whole infantry force getting committed. That was a different level of engagement altogether.
And the dangers they faced personally. Gary Worthy's story from episode 33 is just, well, brutal.
It really is. He sets the scene. A mission with the 1st Infantry Division flying ahead of ground troops. He calls it a pheasant hunt looking for ambushes.
That analogy kind of highlights how routine these incredibly dangerous missions became, doesn't it?
It does. He was training another pilot, W.O. Ballou, and they spotted something suspicious. Looked like a bamboo picnic table, he said. Likely an enemy position.
Yeah, yeah.
Then he got hit. An AK-47 round. It struck his chest plate, the chicken plate armor they wore. He mentions it was made by a brewery subsidiary, oddly enough.
Saved his life, though.
Saved his life, but didn't stop the damage entirely. The round ricocheted up, went through his jaw and into his head.
Oh my God, how did he even function?
He describes being totally disoriented. His observer was obviously freaking out. But somehow, Gary flew the helicopter back towards friendly lines.
The helicopter itself must have been shot up.
He says it took 67 bullet holes on that flight. 67. It's incredible he kept it airborne.
Unbelievable.
Then W. Ballou, the pilot he was training, took over and flew him to the first aid station. Ballou was apparently convinced Gary was dying.
I can imagine.
He called in a WIA wounded in action. And there's this moment at the aid station where Ballou actually pulled his .38 pistol on a doctor.
Pulled a gun. Why?
To make sure Gary got treated immediately. He wasn't messing around. Shows the bond between those guys.
Wow. That's intense. And Gary survived it all.
He did. Medevac to Saigon, then Japan, then Denver. And the amazing part, he went back to active duty, became a Huey instructor pilot.
Incredible resilience. And yeah. He says in episode 33, this whole thing is why he keeps the Loach flying today.
Yeah, it clearly had a profound impact. He wants people to remember what they went through, the history of the Air Scouts. You hear the passion in his voice in that discussion.
Let's talk about Hugh Mills' background, because he brings a different perspective again in episode 33. He started enlisted.
Yeah, 11 Bravo Infantry Airborne qualified. Then went to Armor OCS, Officer Candidate School. He actually says going Armor OCS was the best thing that happened to him.
Interesting path to becoming a pilot.
Very. And his first helicopter flight ever. An OH-6, December 67, thrown right in. He was assigned to D Troop, 14th Cav with the 1st Infantry Division.
And he describes the typical Air Cav troop setup in the episode too, doesn't he?
He does. 10 OH-6 scouts, 10 Cobra gunships, 10 Huey lift ships. And then the infantry platoon they carried, the ARP's aerial rifle platoon.
The self-contained fighting unit, essentially. Yeah. Very flexible.
Extremely. And Mills really emphasizes how the scout's job was partly to protect those ARPs, their infantry buddies.
He also doubles down on that idea of scouts as aerial trackers.
Absolutely. Combat trackers from the air, he calls them. He talks about getting incredibly close to the enemy, seeing faces, sometimes even smelling them.
That close. Wow.
That close. And he has that great phrase for what they looked for. That which God did not put there.
I remember that from the transcript. What did he mean?
Unnatural things in the landscape. Straight lines, right angles, a glint of metal, disturbed camouflage, movement where there shouldn't be. Tiny giveaways of enemy presence.
It speaks to this incredible, like, heightened sense of observation they must have developed.
Totally. He mentions tracking an entire North Vietnamese regiment in 72. That's not just spotting a couple of guys. That's large-scale reconnaissance.
And he tells that story about Joe Bade, right? The guy who designed their patch.
Yeah, from New York City. The point being, Mill says, it wasn't just about formal tracking skills you might learn. It was this innate ability maybe to spot things out of place, honed by constant focus under pressure.
So this constant pressure, the skills, how does it affect the enemy? Did the Air Scouts change enemy tactics?
According to Mills in episode 33, definitely. He said when he first got there in 69, the enemy was pretty quick to shoot at them.
Made sense, I guess. Annoying helicopter buzzing around.
Sure. But then a key decision was made. Arm the scout helicopters, specifically with the XM-27 minigun.
Giving the scouts some serious teeth.
Exactly. And the result, Mills says, was noticeable. The enemy became much more hesitant to open fire and give away their position.
Because now the little Loach could shoot back and shoot back hard.
Precisely. They underestimated what the scouts could see, and now they had firepower too. Plus, the OH-6 itself was relatively quiet for a helicopter.
Allowing for surprise.
Yes. Mills tells this amazing story in the episode about coming upon 28 NVA soldiers who just hadn't heard him approach. Imagine that.
Flying how low, typically?
He describes it as just 4 to 6 feet off the ground sometimes, flying at maybe 40 to 60 knots. So low and relatively slow, it required intense concentration.
And that tracking skill, was it something you just had, or could you learn it?
Mill suggests it was an acquired skill, something you got better at with experience, but instinct played a role too, he felt.
Makes sense. Let's talk about the crew inside that little helicopter. Bruce Huffman details this in episode 33 as well.
Right. It wasn't always just the pilot. Typically, you had the pilot, an observer, and often a crew chief acting as a door gunner.
What were their roles?
Pilot flies, obviously. The door gunner usually had an M60 machine gun, maybe some grenades. Critical for suppressive fire.
And the observer.
Often a really key role. Huffman mentions they were frequently second tour infantry guys, maybe Rangers or LURPs, long range reconnaissance patrol members. They knew the ground perspective.
So they handled maps, radios.
Yeah, map reading, navigating, and crucially managing the multiple radios. They had UHF for air to air, VHF, FM for talking to ground troops, all while flying low and potentially getting shot at. Multitasking doesn't even begin to cover it.
It sounds unbelievably intense. And Huffman himself received the Distinguished Flying Cross, right? He tells that story in episode 33.
He does. It's a gripping account. The DFC is awarded for heroism in flight, needs to be witnessed, a significant act.
What was the situation?
An infantry platoon got cut off at night, completely surrounded, taking heavy fire. The regular lift helicopters tried to resupply them, but got driven off by the intensity of the fire.
Medevac couldn't get in either.
Nope. Couldn't extract the wounded. So Huffman and his crew flew in. Initially, the rules of engagement were tight, don't fire unless fired upon.
But they had Americans trapped.
Exactly. He actually encountered four NVA soldiers near the position and got a pretty direct order from the division commander over the radio, something like, why in the hell are they still alive?
So green light to engage.
Green light. He and his crew chief flew directly over the trapped platoon. The crew chief kicked out bandoliers of M60 ammo, ammo clips, grenades, desperately needed supplies.
While taking fire themselves, presumably.
Oh, absolutely. Then they turned their attention to the NVA attacking the platoon, engaged them directly with the M60 and grenades, and essentially broke the assault, allowed the platoon to hold on.
An incredible act of bravery.
Yeah.
And he emphasizes the teamwork, doesn't he?
Very much so. He's clear in the episode that it wasn't just him. It was his whole crew working together under fire.
It's interesting, though. Gary Worthy mentions in episode 33 that sometimes his crew was different.
Yeah, he talks about flying missions with just a pilot and a gunner, specifically operating the minigun system. So variations existed depending on the unit or mission.
Oh, you mentioned a fourth radio.
The ADF, Automatic Direction Finder. He said they often tuned it to Armed Forces Vietnam radio. Just a little slice of home, I guess, amidst everything else.
The human touch and communication, they had to talk to the Cobras, the ground troops.
Right. UHF usually for the Cobras on a specific Victor frequency, FM for the guys on the ground. Worthy actually mentions relying on the Cobra pilots sometimes for navigation help, as they weren't always focused on the map themselves.
Makes sense, given everything else they were juggling. Now, one of the most, I think, profound parts of that episode 33 discussion is Hugh Mills talking about meeting his former enemies.
It's truly remarkable. He had this desire years later to find out about the specific NVA unit he fought against in a big engagement in January 1972, the one where he was shot down.
How did he even start that process?
Through a contact, Merle Pittman, who had worked with the CIA as a translator, they managed to identify the exact unit.
Which was?
The 10th Company, 8th Battalion, 241st NVA Anti-Aircraft Regiment. And incredibly, they even identified the specific soldier who shot him down.
Wow. Did he meet him?
He did. In 2015, he went to Hanoi with a film crew and met with 17 survivors from that NVA unit, including the man who shot him down, Pam Nakhon.
What must that have been like? Tense.
Mills describes it in the episode as initially tense, yes. But the icebreaker was apparently him asking their ages, finding out they were mostly teenagers back then, just like many Americans.
And common ground emerged.
It seems so. They developed a camaraderie, spent 3 weeks together, even visited the old battle sites. Mills says there was no animosity, no hard feelings.
Just soldiers who had done their duty.
That's exactly how he puts it in the episode. Warriors, soldiers doing for our country. A really powerful perspective on reconciliation. He even jokes about all the rice wine toasts.
A positive experience then, despite the difficult history.
Absolutely. He sounds genuinely moved by it in the discussion.
Going back to Gary Worthy for a moment, how does he reflect on his injury now? Does it still weigh heavily?
In episode 33, he calls it a bad time, acknowledges he thinks about it sometimes, but he's very clear it doesn't control his life. That resilience really comes through again.
It really does. The episode also touches briefly on some other, maybe less common, missions or tech, like people sniffers.
Yeah, Gary Worthy mentions those. Apparently, chemical warfare guys would sit in the back trying to detect enemy presence by smell, essentially.
Did they work?
Hugh Mills sounds pretty skeptical in the discussion. He jokes they mostly picked up monkeys, so maybe not the most effective tool.
Gary also talks about doing BDA, right? Battle damage assessment.
Yes, after B-52 strikes. Flying over to see the results, he tells a story about a near miss during one of those, too. Another reminder of the constant danger.
So many varied missions.
And even working with Vietnamese police, the white mice sometimes, to spot potential draft dodgers, just shows the sheer breadth of tasks they could be involved in.
As they wrap up in episode 33, the conversation turns to legacy, or their final thoughts.
Gary Worthy talks about recognizing the sacrifices of everyone who served in Vietnam, emphasizing they went because their country asked them to. He hopes we learn from it to make the country great again, using that phrase.
And Bruce Huffman.
His point is really about political will. He stresses never committing soldiers to combat without the national will and public support to see it through to victory. He contrasts the national shame, as he puts it, of Vietnam with the support troops get now.
A stark contrast.
Very. But he expresses pride that the American fighting man is finally getting the honor he deserves.
And Hugh Mills' final word in the episode.
He expresses this deep confidence in Americans to always rise to the occasion, citing his own family history back to the Revolution. He sees the legacy in the next generation, the aviation explorers he mentions, who will step up to defend the country. He really emphasizes education, too.
Powerful messages from all three. You know, this deep dive, drawing on that specific Military Tales episode 33 discussion, it really only gives us a glimpse, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much more depth to their experiences than we could possibly cover here. Their knowledge is vast.
It really drives home the value of hearing history directly from the people who lived it. That quote they used at the end of the panel.
History is nutritious, and when you meet these old veterans, dig in.
Exactly. Dig in. It's great advice. We'd really encourage you, the listener, to seek out that full Military Tales episode number 33.
Yeah.
And just generally listen to the stories of Vietnam veterans whenever you get the chance.
Their perspectives are invaluable, truly.